The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
The Book of Serenity, case number 11, Yunmen's Two Sicknesses. Great Master Yunmen said, there are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. One sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. As a result, the light does not penetrate. Another sickness is where you have realized that everything is empty, but you still feel you're in a mist, and so the light does not penetrate thoroughly. About the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. First is if you reach the Dharmakaya, but fall and remain there, and do not extinguish your own opinion about it. Second, if you think it is wrong to continue to make efforts after enlightenment, and minutely examine your own consciousness, and find there is no scar, that is a sickness. So Yunmen takes his name from Yunmen Mountain or Mount Yunmen in China, like so many of our Chinese ancestors. I like the fact that they're named after mountains. And Yunmen came to Mount Yunmen at the age of 64. He finally had his own monastery. Maybe not finally. Maybe he was not in a hurry. But he now had his own monastery, and he taught there from age 64 to age 85, which I find really encouraging. And he was quite the teacher, rightly called Great Teacher Yunmen. He had supposedly, allegedly, 790 disciples, maybe not all at one time, but he had 790 disciples, and many of them experienced what we can call great realization, or we've been calling it enlightenment or awakening. And we had a chance during the summer residency to read together and discuss together a number of koans featuring Yunmen. Not all of them are from this period. Not all of them are from Yunmen when he's an established roshi, which means old teacher in Japanese, with all these monks surrounding him. But this one strikes me as from that period. This is a koan, a story about a teacher who's seen it all, worked with so many students at so many levels, and wants to give them some important advice and then leave it for us. Yunmen had so many disciples, so many of whom became themselves awakened teachers, that there was a whole Yunmen school, like the Caodong school that became Soto Zen, or the Linji school that became Rinzai Zen. Those are the two main living schools of Zen today, but there were five in ancient China, and one of them was the Yunmen school. So this is a story about someone who had been there and done that, and had things to pass on. And now they come to us. So this is as the commentators say, a very subtle koan. And we've been looking at it from different angles. And maybe it seemed elusive for some of us. And I want to in my talk today, zero in on a part that for me can also be simple, can also be very direct, as so many of Yunmen's koans are. And so I want to look just at, in our translation, which is different, from some of the others. I want to look just at the N, this second sickness involving the Dharmakaya. And so let me read this to you again. Second, if you think it's wrong to continue to make efforts after enlightenment, and I would add, and you, this is kind of a part two, and you minutely examine your own consciousness and find there's no scar, that is a sickness. That's a problem. If you think it's wrong to continue your efforts after enlightenment. Yasutani Roshi, one of our lineage ancestors, says in his commentary, sit down here and this too will be an illness. Don't sit down at this point. And what I want to suggest is that this issue of thinking that somehow practice is over, that you can just go ahead, not sit, but sit down. We might say sit back. That this problem has a reverse side that goes all the way back to the beginning of our Zen practice, all the way back to maybe the first time we sit on a cushion in a zendo with other people, which is the problem of thinking that practice is something that leads to enlightenment. That practice is a path to a goal. Practice is a path, but so is awakening. The idea that we are practicing until we become enlightened and we can stop. We don't have to practice anymore. What Yunmen's concentrating on in this koan is the problem at the enlightenment end. What happens if you become self-satisfied and feel that you're done and now you can rest on your accomplishment? And there are times and places where this clearly became a major issue, in places where Zen became really established. In a way, it is not yet here. I'm not saying it's never a problem here in America, but imagine times and places when Zen is firmly established and there are lots of monasteries, and those monasteries can supply people with livings that can become a way of supporting yourself. And maybe there's a temptation to reach a certain level in your Zen practice and then just become a kind of temple administrator. Collect the donations. And this has definitely happened. And then something happens to shake everyone up, to shake Zen up. Zen moving to jumping the ocean to America was a shake up. And I think we're still profiting from that. Zen tends to be very alive here, and not a lot of teachers just sitting back. Let's see. The more successful we are, the greater the danger becomes of institutionalization. But what about at the other end? What about starting out? And this is something we know. We're constantly being reminded of it, and I'm going to remind us once more. I need the reminder as much as you do. That we are not practicing with a goal in mind. We're not trying to become Buddhas. We already are Buddhas. And I asked the Eno to lead us in a couple of readings from Dogen this morning, because Dogen is so clear on this. Dogen even comes up with a term which he calls practice enlightenment. He doesn't even want those to be two words. But practice enlightenment, this is what we do. And what that implies, or has long implied to me, is that enlightenment kind of runs backwards all the way to our first time on the cushion, already enlightened. And practice keeps going to the very end So Yun Men, at age 85, died in full lotus posture on his cushion. Kind of sweet. So practice doesn't end. Enlightenment doesn't really start in some definite place, although there can be experiences of realization that can be recognized by a teacher and can lead to transmission, to passing on the authority to teach. But not done. Hakuin, another Japanese teacher, as important in his way as Dogen is in his, Hakuin lived at one of those times when Zen had become institutionalized and kind of moribund. And Hakuin dedicated himself to reviving it. And he changed the koan curriculum, for example. Our koan curriculum is an elaboration of Hakuin's koan curriculum. And Hakuin, if you get a chance to read his wonderful autobiography, he talks about his discovery of what he calls post-enlightenment practice, which apparently wasn't happening much. The idea had become after enlightenment, yeah, one and done. And Hakuin had many, many Kensho experiences after the one that qualified him to teach. He didn't stop. He kept going. Yun Men kept going. We are advised to keep going, not to sit down, as Yasutani says. We use different words for this experience, and three of them have come up already in my talk: realization, enlightenment, awakening. And I personally incline towards awakening. There are several reasons I do, but one of them is really strong for me at this moment. And that's that awakening is a noun in gerund form. It's a noun made from a verb that's kept its verbal force, awakening. And I like that. So one thing to say, some of us are awakened and some of us are not and are practicing to become awakened. And it's quite another thing to say, we're all awakening here together. We're all awakening. Doesn't stop. Already started. Your first Zazen period. We read that really inspiring selection from Dogen's Bendoa, his wholehearted way. And this is what we try to practice with, a wholehearted way, practice with our whole hearts. That really inspiring passage where he says that one period of Zazen is more effective than if all the Buddhas in all the universes, you know, all exerted their Buddha powers at once. It would not reach the measure of a single person sitting a single period of Zazen. And please don't think, well, not my Zazen. You don't know what I'm doing on the cushion. No, whatever you're doing, you can call Zazen. Let's not judge ourselves. So easy to think it's not us. So important not to worry about that, and to recall what I was taught. That we can't judge our practice. I get emotional because the people who taught me are with me. And I get a little overwhelmed with gratitude to them. So I want to say a little about the part two, what I call part two of this last sentence, which I think could be, for me is, and you. Just to distinguish it, I'll read the whole sentence again. Second, if you think it's wrong to continue to make efforts after enlightenment, and along with that, you minutely examine your own consciousness and find that there's no scar, that is a sickness. That's a problem. So the scar, too, runs all the way through our life of practice. And for me, it began with, I've talked about this before, I'll talk about it again. For me, it began with the fantasy that I could somehow free myself. I could somehow cleanse myself of the scars. And because we're all in this endo-human, we all carry them. We all have scars. You can't get very far in life unscarred. And it's possible to stay stuck with the scars, but it's also possible to think that you can remove them. That it's one thing to heal, and you can heal, but to heal without scars? No. That we don't get to do. And so, for me, it was a problem early on to have that goal, to have that gaining idea, that I could lop off this and that and be better. As long as we think that, then we don't accept our Buddha nature. What could be better than already Buddha? What are we missing? What's extra? What do we want to cut off? Anything we cut off is Buddha, is our Buddha nature. What we want is for our Buddha nature to be able to shine forth. And the scars don't get in the way of that. The scars shine too. And to come out on the other end and feel unscarred, wow, that can get you into a whole lot of trouble. And I was contrasting American Zen to Zen in China and Japan, and kind of by implication, Korea, which is one of our heritages too. But in America, we've already had this problem of teachers who felt that they had no scar. And, you know, these stories become notorious. Don't need to tell them. You've heard them. This idea that you're perfect now. That's not what shining forth your Buddha nature is. It's not perfection. Perfection, actually, perfect comes from the Latin for finished. Perfect means completely finished. But Yu Men is teaching us we're never done. Yasutani again. If you don't, commenting on this part, if you don't sit down anywhere, however you happen to be, you'll naturally accord with the way. So however you happen to be, beginning student, 10 years in, old teacher, Roshi, wherever you happen to be, you'll be in accord with the way by not sitting down, by not resting on your realization, your accomplishments, your laurels, by not thinking you can ever be done. That the way goes to a destination, some kind of palazzo of enlightenment, and now you live there with invisible servants, like in some fairy tale. Doesn't happen. What you get to do is sit in the zendo and be served by servers and jishas. A little bit different. So although Yunmen may seem to be talking to his most advanced students, if we want to say advanced, his longtime students, the ones who will go on to teach themselves in this koan, I want to invite us all to hear the voice of Yunmen speaking to each of us, wherever we are, whoever we think we are at this moment. Whatever our opinion of ourselves is. Again, as Yasutani says, if you don't sit down anywhere, however you happen to be, you will naturally accord with the way. Book of Serenity, Case 11, Yunmen's Two Sicknesses. Great Master Yunmen said, there are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. One sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. As a result, the light does not penetrate. Another sickness is where you've realized that everything is empty, but you still feel you're in a mist, and so the light does not penetrate thoroughly. About the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. First is, if you reach the Dharmakaya but fall and remain there and do not extinguish your own opinion about it. Second, if you think it is wrong to continue to make efforts after enlightenment and you minutely examine your own consciousness and find there's no scar, that is a sickness. Thank you. So let's move in a kind of semicircle so that we can see each other as we enter into Dharma dialogue. And please come forward. You can respond to this koan, to this talk, or to anything, excuse me, that happens to be coming up for you. And I already see a hand. Ray, please.
The word sickness, I've heard the word used before this in Zen sickness. And it always struck me as pretty pejorative, as sickness is something to avoid at all cost. And yet, I've been sick and hospitalized. And what happens in the hospital is that everyone takes care of you. You know, the nurses, the doctors, the aides, everyone. Helps you get back on your feet to restore a sickness over which you have, you know, it's not your fault, but it just shows up in your life. And I think that sometimes, and, you know, sickness is such, you know, and sometimes you don't even know where you're sick. And, you know, mentally, in terms of Zen practice. You don't even know it. And somebody can point it out to you, and you don't even see it. You don't know what the heck they're talking about. And until you see it, somebody can point it out. And I think that's, you know, I look at some of the people who have done things, and they knew better. But yet they did know. We all have our blind spots, our sickness. And just as in a hospital, I've had to rely on other people, then taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, you know, the teachers have, and trusting the practice is, and if that doesn't do it, I just gotta keep sitting.
Yeah. Thank you, Ray. Absolutely, and so important to remind us that sickness, you know, different ways to look at it, and a koan by Yun Men that hasn't come up yet, but that we covered earlier in the residency, begins that sickness corresponds to medicine or interacts with medicine, and no sickness, no medicine. No medicine, no sickness. We can become very dualistic about this, right? And so sickness is bad, medicine is good. And you're suggesting that sickness brings us someplace, that sickness opens Dharma gates for us and allows us to recognize our dependence on other people and our interdependence with other people. And I totally agree. I can't say what you did better, so I'm just rephrasing you a bit.
And you know, since the first talk on Monday, when we've been really looking into this now, I was thinking, I really love Yasutani Roshi calling it condition, not sickness. I think for the very reason that you're talking about, I was thinking, maybe we should change it in our koan curriculum. You know, maybe we should change it to the two sicknesses and to the two conditions. But then we would miss the opportunity, which you just picked up, to look into the real nature of sickness that isn't pejorative and isn't its opposite. And then, you know, there's just to realize for yourself that these are conditions. Yeah, I think you're pointing to something very important. This settles my heart around that translation.
Yeah, Vix.
Thanks for the talk. First, I wanted to share another translation of that koan that I've heard, the medicine and sickness correspond. Another translation that I've heard is sickness and medicine heal each other. Mm-hmm. Where you find yourself, which I like that one.
Yeah.
And the other thing that came up for me is you said that awakening starts the first time you sit. It goes back to the first time you sit, is what you said. What about before that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, before then, right, you're already Buddha, but you're not awake to that fact. So it's not that before then you're chopped liver. But Dogen told us that fences and trees are fully realized Buddhas, right? But they're not awake to that fact. Fences can't express it, can't, as I was saying, shine it forth. And so I would say already Buddha is a little bit different than saying an awakened Buddha or an awakening Buddha. And I think that we here are all awakening Buddhas, all of us, every single one of us, or we wouldn't be here. Yeah, Will.
Thank you for the talk. I guess two thoughts. I may lose one while I'm talking, but let me try to be on point. So I guess I'll say the first one first, and maybe that's all that matters, is that I think it's probably a little personality dependent, but I have a tendency to think, kind of maybe every student does at some point, that, the teachers are right and I'm wrong, and I need to figure out, you know, something that is in the teacher's consciousness, and, you know, I'm trying to apply a theorem and I can't make it work, I keep getting mistakes and so on. It's like it's math class or something. And the antidote to that that I find sometimes welling up in my own mind is Aitken Roche's phrase that you quickly, maybe even immediately, also enter a, he called it a subtle realm where Zazen teaches Zazen. And I do feel that's true for me, is that I, and that's much better. If Zazen is teaching me, I don't sort of externalize and think, oh, there's a model that I, you know, I am distant from. Zazen teaches Zazen. It's just itself. It's just Zazen. But it's not, there is a sense of continual self-correction, I guess you could call it that.
Yeah, I think that's so wonderful. I really, we're kind of taught in school, you know, that the professor will give the grades at the end of the class, thank you, and let you know. I myself was in college before I realized education had anything to do with me. I thought it was a mind reading.
Yeah.
And I did that pretty well, so I did well in school, but that realization. And I think our intention as teachers is exactly what you're saying. If you trust my experience, you're in trouble. I mean, but this coming to rely, it's a little bit what Ray was saying, you know, we need the help of the Sangha and teachers, but ultimately I better just sit a little more. Yeah. Because if I don't realize it myself, no matter what anybody says or no matter how many guessing games, so there is this faith that we learn after we look everywhere else to come to rely on Zazen. Practice teaches us how to practice, not outside, not a millimeter outside.
I also want to add. Oh,
I do too, but you can
okay. I also want to add that so, you know, I'm just going to tell you something you know, Will, but in the spirit of reminding, that Lin Ji talks about our putting a head on top of the head we already have, and that second head, the head on top of the head, is the one that is telling you teachers are right, you're wrong, you know, you don't have the answer, they do, and the beautiful, marvelous, functioning head that you've already got is the one that does Zazen, but also the one that you know, eats food, and the one that gets out of bed in the morning when you hear the bell, and so on. All of that is your marvelous activity, and so I wouldn't limit it at all to Zazen, but I would say that all of these activities teach you, and the more that you that we can do all of them without that head on top of our heads. Just, you know, a laywoman Pong says in a koan, it's as easy as putting our feet on the floor in the morning when we wake up. And if we could go through our day in that spirit, that would be teaching us quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And one of the dangers implicit in what you're saying that I also want to point out, because everything has many sides, is that letting Zazen teach Zazen can also be another head. And people get ideas about what that means. And they become self-enlightened, we say. And don't venerate the history, the lineage, the pointing out nature the teachers do. The original Latin root of education is educare, which means to bring forward. And it actually was a word that originally referred to midwifery. So a midwife doesn't put the baby in and then take it out. You know, the midwife knows that it's a natural process and helps to bring it forward, just like the people in the hospital who help when we're ill. So we all have an illness that is thinking we know what's going on. We don't know what's going on, and we can lose ourselves in an idea about Zazen teaching Zazen, or, you know, the other one, teachers being right and I'm wrong. So this is a great mystery, and it's important for all of us not to get caught in, I got it now, I figured it out, I'm just going to let Zazen teach Zazen, or whatever.
Or,
and maybe
the teacher knows.
You don't have to say anymore, right? What did you say?
I said, or in the teacher knows, and I don't. I can't trust myself.
No, well, that's what you started with.
Yeah,
you don't always have to come back.
So,
right. You can just receive.
So we'll go on to another person.
I'd like to just
Yeah, please, Michael. Yeah. So you can always tell it's a great question that we really appreciate and approve of. We have something.
You know, when you make a teacher an object, whether it's one of these four or Zazen, you are an object. And it always recedes from you, all the time. And you'll never reach it.
So who else? Yeah, Carol.
Not the question, but I appreciate your talk so much. And I had lots of moments of, you know, smiling inside and outside, and then the moment when you said it, and the scar shines too. It's a real smile in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So just thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, and you know, this is a way that we all teach each other, is by letting that be seen, is by not hiding it, not protecting it, as you just let it be seen. So honoring you, Carol. Yeah.
So something about what Will said, is comparing. Teacher has it right, or something has it right, and I'm wrong. And touched in me with the moment where you spoke about the teacher's words to you around not judging the practice. And in my mind, that immediately went to, you know, the whole subtlety of the judgments that we have towards ourselves that arise as we sit and do our best and fail and all this other stuff on Sashim, that these, I don't want to call it patterns, but more like currents in our way of being with ourselves when we're not distracted by all this stuff that usually distracts us, that we may see all those places of judgment, of thinking we should be somewhere else, or we should know this by now, or something about the judgment.
Yeah. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that part of what you're saying is that one of the reasons we come to Sashim is so that those can become exposed and we can see them for what they are. Because they're always there, right, those judgments. But we're not always aware that that's what we're doing. We sit without the usual distractions, and suddenly those voices get louder. And when they get louder, then we can notice, maybe not listen to that one so much. That's telling me it can't be me, that I'm doing it wrong, that you know, I'll never be a good Zen practitioner.
And there's something about that turning that light within, you know, sometimes much easier to take up the practice of being less judgmental and more loving and kind to the outside, but here where we can't be doing that so much, like, so, how is my relationship to myself?
Yeah, nice.
And it's one of the wonderful things about the roles we take on. Many of us are helpers in our life, and that's what we do, and we're pretty good at it. And wonderful bodhisattva action, but lovely here when we're prevented from doing a lot of our habitual shtick. Right? Then, who is there to take care of? What a radical idea.
Well, some of us are helpers and some of us are teachers, and we just have to keep going with our, right? So you don't have to do that role now. You don't have to come back with something. You get to actually just make your beautiful statement, and it's for the benefit of all. We're stuck with having to respond. You know, that's you're free. You don't have to do that. You're not teaching a classroom. You're not, you know, you're free.
It's not that.
Say it again?
It's not that. It's that I feel like I'm trying to say something very subtle that's been very helpful to me, and you say, that's a concept, and you're wrong. That's what I feel.
Mm-hmm. Interesting feeling. Do you want to say more, Will?
No, I wanted to say that. Thank you.
Yeah, Dave.
I just wanted to say thank you for the talk. And some of the things that have been said prior, Michael's word was exposed.
Dave, I really want to hear your words.
It's too soft. Thank you. I'm a mom. Michael's word was exposed. And then yesterday, in Esther's encouragement talk, she talked about opening her heart. Mm-hmm. And I thought in your talk, you did both of those things for me. And it's something that I find to be very difficult to do. It's very hard for me to do that. It's very hard for me to do that. And so I just felt it was inspiring to watch someone do that. And I don't know, for me, your talk had some type of dynamic where it crescendoed to where you talked about your gratitude for your teachers. And there was some type of bird outside that started squawking and screeching right when your crescendo happened. And then when you came down, it stopped. And for me, that bird was so loud, it was intermittent with your talk, and it was screaming to me, saying, listen to this, listen to what he's saying, listen to it, but you gotta do this. So even the bird, I thought, was listening to your talk.
Thank you, Dave. And you have no idea how hard it was to train the bird to do that. So shall we end? Thank you, everyone.